Chapter 26, Elder A.T. Jones' Evening Lecture. The subject tonight is the evils of a union of church and state. I quote from Draper's Intellectual Development of Europe. It was the aim of Constantinople to make theology a branch of politics. It was the hope of every bishop in the empire to make politics a branch of theology. Another quotation is this. These being the two ideas upon which the old and the coming theocracy is and will be built. When once a political aspirant has bidden with the multitude for power, and still depends on their pleasure for effective support, it is no easy thing to refuse their wishes or hold back from their demands. Thus Constantine had virtually sold himself to this power that he wished to control, and could never ignore it and hold his position. Schaff, in his Church History, gives this estimate of Constantine. He was distinguished by that genuine political wisdom, which, putting itself at the head of the age, clearly saw that idolatry had outlived itself in the Roman Empire, and that Christianity alone could breathe new vigor into it and furnish it moral support. It was then entirely as a political thing that he embraced Christianity. Now Constantine adopted Christianity first by a superstition, and put it by the side of his heathen superstition, till finally, in his conviction, the Christian vanquished the pagan, though without itself developing into a pure and enlightened faith. Here you have the history of Constantine in a few words. Did Constantine establish Christianity as the Roman religion? Schaff says, he presumed to preach the gospel. He called himself the Bishop of Bishops. He convened the first general council and made Christianity the religion of the empire long before his baptism. But he did not issue an edict making it the state religion. A statement from Hillman, which he calls the legal establishment of Christianity. Christianity may now be said to have ascended the imperial throne, with a single exception of Julian. From this period the monarch of the Roman Empire professed the religion of the gospel. I want to notice tonight what Constantine did for the church, and what befell it as soon as politics became incorporated with it, and the effect it had upon the church, state, and society, and what it will do again. Neander says, with the commencement of this period, the church entered into an entirely different relation to the state. It did not merely become a whole, recognized, or legal, and tolerated by the state, but the state itself declared its principles to be those to which everything must be subordinated. This is the same argument that the reformers use now, that they will remain distinct, revolving round one another. But you will see the impossibility of this church and state, constituted, henceforth two wholes, one interpreting the other, and standing in relation of mutual action and reaction. The advantageous influence of this was that the church would now exert its transforming power also on the relations of the state. But the measure and character of this power depended on the state of the inner life in the church itself. It was now necessary that one of two things should happen. Either the spirit of Christianity, as it became more widely diffused, must, not by a sudden and glaring revolution, but by its power in the heart, which is far mightier than any arm of flesh, gradually introduce the order of law in the place of arbitrary despotism, or the corruption of the state would introduce itself into the church, as it actually did in the Byzantine Empire. Which did happen. Why the latter, and this must inevitably happen, because a pure church will never ask for civil power, so long as she has the power of God. But losing this, she will grasp for anything she can get. Furthermore, the church was now exposed to the temptations of appropriating a foreign might for the prosecutions of its ends. Mark now this statement. A temptation ever ready to assail man, the moment the spirit is no longer sovereign alone. This is a piece of philosophy you should ever remember, and is true in ecclesiastical affairs as well as civil enforcement of discipline. Now as to what Constantine did for the church, The speaker read many extracts to show how the Christians, living as they pleased, would will their property to the church, and that act carried them through to heaven. By this means, the church became immensely wealthy. In 313, Constantine freed the clergy from all state taxation, the removal of a great burden. The result was hundreds joined the clergy to get rid of these burdens. These two corrupting influences soon made the bishops almost equal in power to the emperor himself, and opened the way for men to profess Christianity for power and wealth. Next, Constantine would build a church where there was not a Christian, and sending a bishop and clergy there, would pay a piece of gold and a white garment to whoever would be baptized and support every convert. The result was crowds would become Christians. In places where the Christians were few, he would offer special inducements, and whole cities would turn to Christianity. Pagans, philosophers, and teachers would turn Christians to teach paganism in the schools. Just as soon as Christianity had political influence and political favor to bestow, it brought the very worst characters in the church. And so it will be in every church where politics is given a prominent place, and the outcome can only be a papacy. If any nation favors any particular religion, men will flock to it for the emoluments to be obtained. The baser element will push itself to the front and use their positions for political advancement. Neander says, the more the church strove after outward dominion, the more she was liable to go astray and to forget in this outward power her own intrinsic essence as a church of the Spirit, and the more easy it became for outward power to have dominion over her. By the temporal advantages connected with the spiritual profession, they call a man to office not so much for his spiritual qualifications as for his political power. Many who had neither the inward call nor any other qualifications for this order were led to aspire after church offices, so that in fact numbers became Christians solely with a view of obtaining some post in the church and enjoying the emoluments therewith connected. When that man ran for a bishopric, and these men supported him, he had to do as they wished and preach such doctrine as pleased them, or he was removed. Men were made bishops who were not Christians. What would now be called a worldling, this being called a Christian nation, all will have a voice in the church, and the officers will deal in political intrigue for office, and the rabble will force their candidates upon the church, and as in Rome, the worst kind of men will be elected to keep them from harming the church. It sometimes happened that by the voice of the whole community, or of a powerful party in it, some individual standing high in their confidence was proclaimed bishop. But as, in the then existing state of the church, the most pious and they who had a right conception of the essence of the spiritual office and who had at heart the spiritual interests of the community did not constitute the majority and the most powerful party. Thus, in the year 361, the popular party at Caesarea in Cappadocia, supported by the garrison of the place, insisted upon having for their bishop one of the civil magistrates, Eusebius, who had not as yet been baptized, and the provincial bishops, many of whom perhaps had a better man in mind, allowed themselves to be forced to ordain him. Now Schaff tells more about that man than Neander. Sometimes the people acted under outside considerations and the management of demagogues, and demanded unworthy or ignorant men for the highest offices, working up the primaries as is done now in large cities like Chicago, New York, etc. In a note, he says, many were elected on account of their badness to prevent the mischief they would otherwise do. Do you not see how this corrupting influence drew the church down and down in degradation? Another statement from Neander. The vast numbers who from external considerations, without any inward call, join themselves to the Christian communities, serve to introduce into the Christian church all the corruptions of the heathen world. Pagan vices, pagan delusions, pagan superstitions took the garb and name of Christianity, and were thus enabled to exert a more corrupting influence on the Christian life. Such were those who, without any real interest whatever in the concerns of religion, living half in paganism and half in an outward show of Christianity, composed the crowds that thronged the churches on the festivals of the Christians, and the theaters on the festivals of the pagans. That is the papacy, and what then is the papacy, but paganism under a Christian name? It was natural that the bad element, which had outwardly assumed the Christian garb, should push itself more prominently to notice in public life. Hence it was more sure to attract the common gaze, while the genuine Christian temper loved retirement and created less sensation. The genuine Christians were pushed into the background. From the day Constantine proposed Christianity, the history of the Church has not been the history of Christianity. The history of Christianity closed with the Acts of the Apostles, to be opened again when Luther left the Church. The balance is the history of the papacy. So then, the worldly Christians were as separated from the genuine Christians as the pagan had been. In Milman I read, "On the incorporation of the Church with the state, the coordinate civil and religious magistracy maintain each its separate powers, and on the one side, as far as the actual celebration of the ecclesiastical ceremonial, and in their own internal affairs in general on the other, in the administration of the military, judicial, and physical affairs of the state, the bounds of their respective authority were clear and distinct." The assertion, then, that the Church and state constitute two wholes is not possible. There are a few things where the jurisdiction of each is clearly defined. But there are thousands of points where it would be impossible to tell where the jurisdiction of the Church stops and that of the state begins. So far the theory was distinct and perfect. Each had its separate and exclusive sphere. Yet there could not but appear a debatable ground on which the two authorities came into collision, and neither could altogether refrain from invading the territory of his ally or antagonist. When you get religion into politics, where is the limit going to stop? The Church takes cognizance of every relation of life. Now then, if she has control of the civil power, how can you prevent her carrying it into the thoughts of the heart? It cannot be done. The best things, when perverted, become the worst. So of Christianity, it being the best thing the world ever saw, perverted will be the worst. On the other hand, the state was supreme over all its subjects, even over the clergy in their character of citizens. But there was another prolific source of difference. The clergy, in one sense, from being the representative body, had begun to consider themselves the Church. But in another and more legitimate sense, the state, when Christian, as comprehending all the Christians of the empire, became the Church. Which was the legislative body? The whole community of Christians, or the Christian aristocracy, who were in one sense the admitted rulers? By this time they had made the distinction of the laity and the clergy, which did not belong to the Church of Christ, who then chose the officers. Did not the state fairly succeed to all the rights of the laity, more particularly when privileges and endowments attached to the ecclesiastical offices were conferred or guaranteed by the state, and therefore might appear in justice revocable, or liable to be regulated by the civil power? Don't you see that every step in the papacy is logical? And do you not see that in the work of the reformers, each of these steps is in it, and must logically follow? When once the civil power was recognized as cognizant of ecclesiastical offenses, where was that power to end? Of the religious condition of Rome at the time, Milman says, "Thus in a great degree, while the Roman world became Christian in outward worship and in faith, it remained heathen, or even at some periods worse than heathenism in its better times as to beneficence, gentleness, purity, social virtue, humanity, and peace. Heresy of opinions became almost the only crime against which excommunication pointed its thunders. Thus, Christianity became at the same time more peremptorily dogmatic and less influential. It assumed the supreme dominion over the mind, while it held but an imperfect and partial control over the passions and appetites. The theology of the gospel was the religion of the world. The spirit of the gospel, very far from the ruling influence of mankind. Whenever a national religion is established, heresy is the highest crime, because the state becomes the guardian of the soul and expects to be held responsible for its guardianship. Hence, punishes blasphemy against the established religion as speaking against the soul itself. This is the kind of system that comes in whenever you have a union of church and state.